Hello, everybody, and welcome to our webinar on chart delineation. Today we've got two guest presenters, Vera and Ray, and then Eva will also be doing a presentation on a person for us. It will be recorded, but the slides will not be because we're just doing the charts today. So I think everybody knows how to raise their hand, how to type me questions if you need to, although we do ask that you let the individuals get through their presentation first before you ask questions, please. Okay, so I hope you guys are ready to start. Vera, please.
Yeah, good. Yes, I chose a Spanish composer, Manuel de Falla. I was first drawn to his music, and it was rather his early music. That music is drawing on flamenco style, but it's a modern, it's a very powerful music, passionate, strong. And probably I was resonating with the fourth and sixth ray, which I thought are in my in Falla's makeup, so I have them myself. Okay, he was born in Cádiz in Spain on 23rd November 1876. He was a well-known Spanish composer, and mostly known and played are now his early works drawing on the flamenco style, and most famous is probably the ritual fire dance from El Amor Brujo, and also very well known the Nights in the Spanish Garden, very beautiful evocative music. At Falla's time, Spain as a country was redefining its identity from being a defeated empire after it lost its war with United States. And Spain became a much smaller player. So Falla played a role in that through, as a composer, through defining that new Spanish identity. And so he looked at the cultural roots. We can see contrasts in Falla's life and his works. Composer's music is like a window into his personality and soul. Falla later dissociated from his early works, and he even forbid at one time to play these works for fear that they would make a bad influence on people. His later music reflects more from personal, nationalistic sense to more international and modern style, sort of, and I call it more like mental music. Falla's motivation and driving force in life was work, work and living according to his high moral standards. He was a deeply religious man, held the vision of God above all. He believed in ultimate liberty, freedom to act upon the dictates of the conscience, which came only from total obedience to God. So that was his high ideal. I believe that Falla was a disciple, the first initiate, and working towards his second initiation. He was born into a well-off family. Father was a successful businessman, and he was a sensitive child, had a sheltered childhood, and he was encouraged to develop his interests. So, nice childhood. After he finished his studies at conservatory, his father's business faltered and Falla had to assume financial responsibility for his family. Having this extra responsibility was pinning him down. He had to give piano lessons and do more mundane sort of music work. And he took whatever little contract was available to provide for the family. I didn't put off the hook my phone. He formed many contacts with other musicians, and his correspondence was prolific. So he was able to make good networks. One of his friends and co-workers was even Federico Lorca. well-known personality, poet, very progressive, openly homosexual, and that was a very no-no in that time in Catholic Spain. So Falla was, in some sense, he wasn't applying that rigid religious feeling to his contacts. That's what I wanted to say. He also worked with very progressive composer Stravinsky, and he kept pace with new trends in music, but formed his own style. And his music was constantly developing with quite an ease, jumping from one style to another. When he was young, he fell in love with his distant cousin, was rejected by her family. This affected him deeply, and he remained unmarried. Some speculate that he was a homosexual, but there was no evidence for that. Later, when he was in his 40s, he lived with his sister, who also was unmarried. During the Spanish Civil War, we all know it's a very, very hard, difficult time, Falla sided first with the Republicans, and even when Federico Lorca was arrested, Falla appealed to the officials for his release, but yeah, was unsuccessful. Lorca was killed, and Falla did it at his personal risk to save his friend. As the events and violence unfolded and churches were being attacked by some Republican factions, Falla could not reconcile that with his deep commitment to God. He took the attacks on church as attacking the God himself. Because he was at the time already a non-composer and a public figure, the officials of the regime, fascists, made successful effort for Falla to be seen as a supporter of that regime. And Falla was struggling with that, because it was an irony, because he always strived to be above politics, not being involved in it. It wasn't worth of the high ideals. But he ended up being exploited by people in power and used in their propaganda. The Civil War events weakened Falla's physical constitution and affected his psychological well-being. He had health problems, mainly with lungs, I think it was tuberculosis, and his work suffered. He had not produced any major work from the 30s onwards. In 1939, he was invited to conduct a concert in Argentina, went there with his sister, and they decided to stay there till Falla's death in November 1946. So actually, he died in Scorpio, so my understanding is that he will be born again in Scorpio. And at that life, he had Scorpio rising. Hypothetical ray chart. I put his soul ray as ray 6, because the striving to fulfill the will of God and not to fail in the eyes of God was his overriding aspiration in life. His personality I put as ray 4, strive to express his highest ideals through music, beauty. And in respect of the Ray 4, a part of exhibiting sort of this appreciation for harmony and beauty in the arts and nature, he showed great indecisiveness, inner torment, frustration and moodiness. He was seeking peace and harmony in life, but also had those unresolved dualities in his life, such as reconcile sensuality and morality. Like when I mentioned that music, his early music, he considered to be that because it was sensual, that it would have more bad influence on people. Duality of his work and private life. His work, he was very was expensive and creative, but the private life was very constricted. He lived almost like an ascetic later on. So, and also dualism of this idealism and lack of practicality. He seemed to keep division between profane and sacred, which indicates his personality not fully integrated with the soul. His mental body I put also as A4, and I probably am wrong, but it was my reasoning. The energies of Sagittarius' sun were helping fire develop the lower mind and support the mental focus on a higher level. This was supported by Mercury in Scorpio and conjuncting his ascendant. He lived in his mind mainly. Again, dualities in his thinking, difficulties making decisions, changing mind. He agonized over every detail and decision, and he was a perfectionist. I couldn't find this perfectionism, and then I realized, his south node is in Virgo. His astral body I put as Ray 2. He struggled to resolve sensuality and morality and opting for rather ascetic personal life. But he himself, he was not a subject to strong emotions as, it's from the sources I read. But he understood strong, powerful feelings, as is clearly evidenced in his in that early music. He was a peaceful and kind man, generous to his students in terms of time and attention he paid to them. He was always polite and proper in dealing with people. His physical body I put as Ray 7. This ray is the least evident in his chart, but fire was very orderly and routine in his daily life. He was always carefully dressed with sort of with an air of elegance, and his body was fragile and sensitive. So that's my reasoning. And chart, looking at the overview of the chart, the houses are fairly balanced with a slight edge towards introversion. The elements are also fairly balanced with water and fire slightly dominating. Ascendant is in Scorpio. Scorpio transmits Ray 4. Esoteric keynote is warrior am I, and from the battle I emerge triumphant. Scorpio's purpose is to test and eventually to triumph over any negative traits. We know that. Exoteric rulers Pluto and Mars. His Pluto is in Taurus in the seventh house and is opposite of his ascendant, indicating work of personality and soul fusion. Also that indicating that in the seventh house are some important issues relating to that house to be looked at. Fire expressed positive traits of Scorpio very much, that's determination, loyalty, ambition, intuition. He came to recognition in his field through very hard work. Going back to that Pluto in seventh house, the seventh house is about relationships, marriage, hidden enemies. We'll talk about it later when talking about the earth. Fire, in terms of relationships, he avoided entering into close relationships for whatever reason. And yeah, he ended up this preferring emotional convenience of sharing household with his sister. She was his personal secretary as well. And he considered too much pondering on himself as selfish self-absorption. It remains open how much of the old patterns he managed to uncover and transform, because he wasn't sort of exposed. Close relationships are like mirrors, and we can see those hidden patterns are more obvious for us to see them, and so he had not that opportunity. The esoteric ruler of Scorpio is Mars, and that is in Libra, in the 11th house. This house is about group activities and affiliations, spiritual vision and aspirations. With the esoteric ruler in the 11th house, fire soul purpose was to become more group or soul conscious. And I see that as he did it through his work, fulfilling this task. He was considered to be the most innovative Spanish composer of the first half of the 20th century and played that role in that Spanish identity in music. Okay, Sun in Sagittarius, in the first house with Jupiter and Mercury there as well. Sagittarius turns with 3, 4, 5 and 6. Exoteric ruler is Jupiter, Ray 2, and is in the first house in his own sign, so it's a very strong position. Jupiter is about expansion of consciousness, and in this chart, Jupiter is not aspected with any other planet, so its influence was not moderated in any way. And I think that a part of helping this expansion of consciousness, that this might account for some excesses fire displayed, such as too much fussing about detail, too much tormenting himself over everything he was doing. So he was doing a little bit too much in whatever he was doing. Sagittarius' higher purpose is to develop a one-pointed mind and reorient to a higher spiritual goal. Fire displayed in his life the positive traits of the sign, such as intellectual astuteness, generosity, and to a large extent the ability to be adventurous and optimistic, adventurous in the music, in his work. And his focus was definitely more on ideals than on practical matters. First house is about identity and how the soul projects into the person's life. So it's very important house. There is a stellium in the first house, stellium created by more than 3 planets. And this stellium includes Mercury in Scorpio, then Sun and Jupiter in Sagittarius. This means issues needing to be worked out in relation to his identity. And of interest is that his music also was connected to the national identity. So that's esoteric ruler of Sagittarius is Earth and is in the seventh house as the Pluto. The Earth transmits 3-3. Earth in Gemini helps one to think before reacting, to communicate with simplicity and consideration, and to ground ideas into matter. Fire took great care in the way he communicated. He went to great lengths not to be misunderstood or not to offend anyone. But in practical matters, he was not good in business matters. He lacked self-confidence and assertiveness. He was too polite and nice, but also slightly resenting the situation he was in, the financial struggles and a necessity to attend those practical matters. He has in his chart 2 grand crosses. That's the overall pattern in his chart. Planets forming squares and oppositions, and they happen to form 2 so-called grand crosses. First, I noticed just one, but then BL pointed up to the other one. This indicates a need for integration of the opposing energies and patterns. And this configuration presents derating issues with more urgency and pins down the individual and forcing him to deal with the issue. So it's like less scope for other options. It's just like, look at it. And there's no escape from it. One of the crosses is mutable. The other one is fixed. And they involve the crucial planets. Sun forms the mutable cross via his Sun-Earth axis, squaring his IC-MC axis. This IC is conjuncted with Saturn. The other is formed by Moon and Uranus axis and Pluto and Ascendant. Ascendant also conjuncts Mercury. It is said that the patterns involved in the fixed cross are more difficult to resolve, transform. And in this chart, that involves Moon and Pluto. And yeah, so they are deep, karmic, deep-seated issues. I will now talk about Moon in Aquarius. Moon is in Aquarius in the third house, prison of the soul. And third house is about communication issues. It's about the lower mind and how we use it. According to Alan Oken, the personality is often the server of the lower mind, and the thoughts and ideas there are often mental programs inherited from one's family and society. There is not much evidence that fire would dwell on his personal dilemmas, as I mentioned before, or subjected them to scrutiny. He believed that it would be selfish. And exoteric ruler of Aquarius is Saturn, conjunct his moon. Saturn is in Pisces, Pisces sensitivity, absorbing what is around, and it's in the fourth house. Again, so his moon and Saturn indicate karmic inheritance and potential crises in the life arising from the family, home environment, from one's roots and traditions. As I said, his childhood was good, but he probably was supposed to work more with these traditions, cultural. And yeah, the other exoteric ruler of Aquarius is Uranus, and is in Leo in the ninth house, opposite his moon. Ninth house is about the spiritual integration. Of interest is that the Moon and Uranus, together with Pluto and Ascendant, are part of the fixed cross. So it's, yeah, Aquarius transmits ray 5. The personality on the lower level desires the thought life and the acquisition of knowledge and intellectual property, wants to be recognized as being special and superior, lacks ability to bring ideas to fruition on the physical plane, living in mental isolation, being individualistic and fixed-minded. And fire seems to display some of these weaknesses to various extent. Exoteric ruler of Aquarius is Jupiter, ray 2, and it's in Sagittarius in the first house. Jupiter conjuncts his sun. The ruler of his moon is working closely with the higher personality goals he had. So Fire Soul wanted him to expand his consciousness, to open his heart and to be more inclusive in spirit, to dedicate himself to the service of humanity. He definitely fulfilled that in terms of his work, but on the personal level, his personal issues, yeah, we don't know. The moon, only he knows, probably now. The moon can also represent the physical body and therefore the brain. The ray 5 of Aquarius indicates the importance of perfecting the lower mind so that it becomes an instrument of the soul. This ray gives the ability to find and apply the knowledge that will enable that transitions in consciousness. And in that sense, that ray 5, using that analysis of ray 5, I think the fire may not have cleared all his old limiting patterns completely, that his prudish approach to life and anxiety of not failing in the eyes of God, preventing him to be exposed to a wide variety of situations, which would reveal some of those deep-seated patterns. As I mentioned before, like those close relationships might have provided him with this more psychological understanding of himself and in other people. The professional relationships, and he had many, they provided enough distance, and he always could sort of exit them, so they were not that challenging. On the positive side, he pursued perfection in music, and he realized in his many works that, and I think he fulfilled that expensive task of expanding consciousness for himself and others through the music. So I will be happy to achieve in my life what he had achieved. And that's the end of my presentation.
Okay. Hello? Very good, Vera. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Vera? Okay. He sounds like a very interesting person. And I think you're spot on with your ray analysis of this man. I just wonder about the second ray astral body. I kind of think that with everything that was going on in his life, and for him to have this fiery essence and the fiery music, maybe I would consider a sixth ray. But then again, I haven't read his biography, and I don't know anything about him except what you've offered. So I'm just putting that out, because the second ray astral is a very calm, usually a calm individual.
But he, as a personality, he was a very kind and a rather shy man.
Uh-huh.
That was the puzzle, what actually attracted me to that word. Yeah.
Dichotomy here in what you're saying. Uh-huh. Okay, well, you know, as I said, I haven't read his stuff, so I really don't know. It's just that I keep thinking of that fiery music and that. Mm.
Yes. That second ray must have been somewhere.
You're probably right. As I said, I don't know. I thought your explanation of the various placements of the planets and the signs was excellent. You covered most everything, you know, so I'm not going to go over the crosses, because that's the most poignant thing I see as I look at this chart, are his two crosses, which means that he had a very challenging life. We cannot take that away. And if in fact he had 4-3 personality and 4-3 on the mind, you can see how all these challenges would create these crises for him and these difficult, ways of having to live through that. You say he had a good home life, and many times when we look at a Pluto and the Moon combination, especially when it's a challenge, like it's a square here, in traditional astrology, they always point to the feminine, the mother, and whether he had difficulty with his mother or whether he had some kind of feminine qualities to himself, you know, and struggled with that. We don't know, right? I'm just pointing out this because...
He had a good relationship with his mother, but a very cold relationship with the father. And maybe those feminine qualities, yes. He did display some of me.
Yeah, and you see, and that may have been very a crisis-like within himself, you know, creating that conflict within himself, because it is a challenge, after all. And then it brings in the ability to communicate. Did he suppress that communication? Did he relate to it? Did he relate it to others? You know, again, we see that both in the seventh house and the third house, which are the houses of the relating process. So I thought you pointed all these things out exceptionally well. There's only one area I want to touch on, or is it more than one? One area, basically, and that is Saturn in Pisces. As I've mentioned many times before, Saturn, as we know, is limiting. It's concretizing. It creates blocks in Pisces, you know, and Pisces wants to flow. It wants to, you know, you want to be absorbed in it and swim in it. So there might be difficulty in the life with that combination. A lot of people who have that have sometimes psychological problems because the astral plane could be it could be a door into the astral plane. There could be disturbances in the psychic life. It's sometimes hard to really understand the person, to get into their psyche. You know, some people with this combination can hear voices. Now, maybe he heard music in his mind, you see, because of that astral connection. And many artists see or hear or get the visions well before they manifest them. So that could speak to that as well, you see, being able to manifest Saturn, that which he receives from his imagination, his astrality. We could see that too. And that, go ahead.
Comment, because there is also in Pisces that North Node, and it, does it mean that North Node indicates what we are supposed to learn and achieve? Well, so can you comment on that?
Yeah, it indicates. Let me just, before I go into that, because this is all tied together, you see the Saturn is directly opposite his MC. And yes. MC is his profession. It's the way the world sees him. So the world saw him as this person who had the ability to manifest whatever his imagination, whatever his inner psychic life brought to the fore. Especially when you see Neptune, the ruler of Pisces, in a fourth ray sign of Taurus. Pisces we usually attribute to some kind of artistic ability, musicality, dancing, that kind of stuff. So I can see how that fourth ray, you see, Neptune in Taurus, Scorpio rising, there's so much fourth rayness to it, and the musicality, of course, is the way he manifested that. Now, so the world saw him as this musician, as this talented person who had that ability to bring that to the life. Now, the North Node is the destiny. The North Node is the destiny, and as I will point out when I talk about Krishnamurti, destiny is ultimately brought about by the personality, because it's the choices that we make in life which either fulfills the destiny, comes close to the destiny, or is the destiny. You see what I'm saying? But it's personality choices based on soul purpose. So the soul purpose is the impetus, but then the personality has to carry that out. And not always do people fulfill what the chart shows as their destiny. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's all I really would like to say, because I think you covered everything quite well. And I see we're running a little bit late in time, and I want to give everybody a chance. So BL, is there anything you'd like to say?
Yes, I just want to bring up the crosses. You did a very, you know, like Eva said, you did an excellent job, and I don't need to say much on the crosses because you brought them up. But I do want to point out that astrologically, those two crosses are conjunct each other, but they're out of sign. And that's, you know, as you mentioned, one of them is mutable. That's the sun opposite the earth, squared by Saturn and his midheaven there, okay? So those are the mutable ones, and those are the ones that are probably going to be a little bit easier on him. But that sun is conjunct his ascendant, and both of those are considered luminaries, so you're allowed to have wide conjunctions. They're 10 degrees apart, but they're still conjunct each other. And as you pointed out several times, that shows the ability to work the personality towards the soul issues. It doesn't mean he's mastered it. They're out of sign, so he's going to have to work for it. And as you pointed out, the same thing with the moon. The moon is square his ascendant, square Pluto, opposite Uranus in that massive fixed cross that he's got with the hard players in it. As a matter of fact, both of his crosses between them have all the hard players in them. But that gives him that the opportunity to work through those struggles. I believe you said that you thought in the end some of those struggles actually broke him in the end. But inwardly, I'd like to think that he overcame them. So,
okay.
I think that's massive that those two are conjunct each other, out of sign, different purposes, different planets involved, but they're still conjunct each other.
Okay.
One thing I forgot to mention here with Saturn. Can you see the Saturn here at 1 degree Pisces, right? And look where it squares. It squares the sun at 1 degree Sagittarius. So it's not in a favorable place, that Saturn. And of course the Earth. And then MC. So that Saturn isn't favorable, is what I'm trying to point out. It's a struggle. That Saturn in Pisces for him created, I am sure, a lot of hardship and a lot of crisis in his life. It's these two combinations of Saturn and Pisces are not easy at the best of times, and yet they're squared the sun, they're squared the earth, and they're squared his midheaven. So that's struggle in itself, you see. Okay, that's all.
Thank you. Very, very well done. Okay.
Thank you.
Ray, you're up.
Okay. On Prince Charles, Prince of Wales, Duke of Cornwall. He was born on the 14th of November, 1948, and has a Leo ascendant, a Scorpio sun with a Taurus moon. And considering his position and influence, his playing out of his personality in public, his opinions that always make headlines, we can assume that he has a certain amount of soul growth attributed to him. And therefore, that will be the sort of angle from which I shall approach this delineation. Prince Charles is heir to the British monarchy, and heirs always take the title of Prince of Wales. They have no real role while waiting to ascend to the throne. Therefore, they would normally find things to do that are beneficial either to themselves or to the country. Charles has immersed himself in his charity work under the Prince's Trust and has contributed immensely to the benefit of those who have just wanted a chance in life and would grab it if the opportunity arose. So looking at his ray analysis, looking at the ray chart, we find that the fourth ray of harmony through conflict dominates this illustration. On the face of it, this ray tells the story of Charles's earlier life, much controversy and difficulties with the press, talking to plants, stories that the public found quite funny, and also his acrimonious divorce from Diana that played out in public, and all the tortured figure stories. They all tell the tale of the fourth ray. His mental type is Ray 4, I would think, for it is through the beauty of his painting and his accurate perspective in the environment he finds achievement on a personal level. He is very sensitive to beauty in architecture, and all around the built environment he champions the best in quality and design, and does not tolerate works done for financial gain rather than that of beauty. He is a very aesthetic individual. His own Institute of Architecture bears out the importance to him of architectural eye candy, but his intellectual nature may tend towards Ray 3. So the hemisphere and quadrant analysis, the 4-10 split of the north-south hemisphere shows inward tendencies and subjectiveness, introversion, like in his home company. We know that he has a love of country pursuits, has spent over 20 years re-landscaping his large estate at Highgrove in Gloucestershire, and he dislikes the press, or he appears certainly to. The east-west split of the hemisphere, the 6-8 split, shows a greater emphasis on group-initiating aspects rather than self-initiating. So he will have had many advisors to help him develop his outlook. As to the quadrant split, these help to pinpoint our focus and houses 1-3, personal identity, where he has 2 counts, self-development. Houses 4-6, where he has 8 counts. This means personal expression, family relations, inner security, and the count is highest here. So a really important quadrant for him. Houses 7-9 deal with social identity and worldly issues, an area which the prince has an interest, although no planets therein. He's been quite vocal in this area, actually. For example, see his comments on the Chinese rulers when Hong Kong was handed back to the Chinese in 1999, describing them as appalling old waxworks. And houses 10 to 12 have to do with social expression and public service. And this is a count of 4. This is an important area for him. One might think that this house should be more fully populated, considering he is an heir. But his public service is well documented and vast. His Prince's Trust has helped so many young people to get a start in life. So, on to the Ascendant, that incorporates some of the Sun analysis because he's got Leo rising, and the Sun is obviously the ruler of Leo. He has the power to lead, and he has the intellect to lead in a wise and authoritative way. Leo's negative traits of arrogance and impatience seem to be the more obvious personality faults that can be observed in Charles. Overcoming them with the positive traits of kindness and loyalty has most likely been achieved, judging by his public appearances. We know that he takes his role in life very seriously indeed. Pluto is in Leo in the first house, and rules Scorpio, and the sun is in Scorpio, his ascendant ruler. Therefore, we have a mutual reception between the Sun and Pluto. Mutual reception strengthens both planets, and they work well together. Leo's Sun has all the planets circling around it, and the unregenerate Leo individual believes himself to be the center of his universe. He is dimly aware of his surroundings, and that's shown by the lower keynote. Let other forms exist. I rule because I am. Because he's so intent on himself, I would consider that Charles has passed this stage and is expressing the soul-centered ruler and traits. The esoteric ruler of Leo is also the Sun. His website carries his mission statement, which is, the Prince of Wales, as heir to the throne, seeks, with the support of his wife, to do all he can to use his unique position to make a difference for the better in the United Kingdom and internationally. So his soul is using the Sun to carry out the mission statement, and we can assume then that Charles is a disciple of some importance. As the soul infused Leo grows, and through its rays 1 and 5, it becomes a powerful force for good. He makes a good leader of men. Ray 5 will give the concrete knowledge of the reality that he is not the center of his universe, at least not until he becomes king, and allows his other Leo Ray, Ray 1, to drive him forward with the power for good. The esoteric keynote of Leo from the angle of the soul is, I am that, and that I am. His demeanor exudes an importance which says that he will be a king one day. His chart indicates that he could certainly be so. The subjective side of Charles is indicated by the sun's position in the fourth house, illustrating a home-loving man. Another point worth mentioning is the first house Pluto that transforms, and Charles' earlier life, which is a first house characteristic, most likely was transformed by the death of Diana, in which it was said that he took himself off into the woods of his estate and agonized over the death, and maybe he shared some of the blame. In any case, the death of Princess Diana must have changed him considerably. Many of the positive expressions of the Leo Ascendance Ray 1 are evident. Steadfastness, power to rule, strength, courage are all there, together with Ray 5's expression of common sense and accuracy in what he says and does, and a keen intellect. Some of the negative expressions of Ray 5 also appear at times, like harsh criticism and lack of sympathy. And then more about the sun analysis. Prince Charles' sun is in Scorpio in the fourth house. And this quote of, I'm not sure who actually made it, but I'm quoting it. In Scorpio, the disciple undergoes those tests which will enable him to take the second initiation and demonstrate that the desire nature is subdued and conquered. We look at the sun sign to tell us what personality traits he has brought forward from past lives. Negative traits of Scorpio are jealousy, moodiness, secretiveness, resentfulness, and manipulating. Of these, it could be difficult to tell which he may have overcome, but from his public life, one might deduce that moodiness may still linger in there somewhere. Let Maya flourish and deception rule is the exoteric phrase for Scorpio, and let's hope he may have overcome the negative traits with the positive ones of determination, intuition, loyalty and ambition. Loyalty to the Queen and his role towards the monarchy are self-evident, and we can deduce that there is ambition there to become king. The sun's fourth house position will indicate that his home is where he is to hone his personality, and the work has to be done to round out his nature so that he will become accepted by the British people to reign as king. We know he spends much time at home and supervising all the gardening projects that has transformed the Highgrove estate and its grounds. The esoteric keynote for Scorpio is Warrior Am I, and from the battle I emerge triumphant. Scorpio is a fourth ray sign, and some of the vices of Ray 4 that may be apparent in Charles's life are worrying, strong passions and indolence, although the virtues are just as if not more apparent, courage and generosity and strong affections. The mutual reception I spoke about earlier allows for the first house Pluto at 16 degrees Leo to become the sun, which trines the mid-heaven degree at 13 degrees Aries. They trine Mars at 20 degrees of Sagittarius in the fifth house, which sets up a grand trine. The tenth house would normally be involved with one who is to be king, and the grand trine, together with the mutual reception, helps to emphasize the statement. Mars is also the esoteric ruler of Scorpio, and its placement in the fire sign of Sagittarius adds more evidence of kingship. Furthermore, esoterically, the sun veils Neptune, the heart of the sun, so that would be his chart soul ruler. with Neptune conjoining the nadir down in the fourth house, he opposes the midheaven. Even more evidence of kingship. So balancing the Sun-Earth axis by houses 4, his home life, and 10, his public life, is something of great importance to someone in Charles's position. The exoteric issue with the Taurus-Scorpio axis is practical versus compulsive, possessiveness versus intensive. The esoteric purpose of the Taurus-Scorpio axis is learning to use the wisdom of the soul to overcome desire through right thought, right action, and right relationships. The exoteric issue with the 4/10th house axis is to make room for both a successful contribution to society, along with caring, reciprocating connections, and a domestic base that helps him feel secure. The higher spiritual purpose of the 4/10th house axis is utilizing your sacred foundations to build on spiritual responsibilities and goals for this life. As a very public figure now, and more than likely will be more so in the future, he will always need his home to recover and realign himself from his public duties. So getting the right balance here is very important. So the moon analysis, and the moon is often the prison of the soul and represents the past. Its position in the chart depicts all the past influences of previous lives that make us what we are today. Charles's moon is in the earthy sign of Taurus in the 10th house, conjunct the moon's north node. The moon is exalted in Taurus and is very comfortable there. It makes for materialistic ways that want to be gratified, for example, excesses of the appetites, stubbornness, self-indulgent behavior, and possessiveness. It makes the person go from one crisis to another in search of gratification, so witness some of the early controversies that Charles had to work out in the public domain. The exoteric key phrase for Taurus is, "Let struggle be undismayed." These traits should be counterbalanced with the positive ones, such as persistence, patience, practicality, and dependability. Being in the 10th house of the public outer world, these should be cultivated for the public benefit, to show that he has become a person worthy to become a king. The esoteric keynote is, "I see, and when the eye is opened, all is illumined." And that may need to be worked upon. This is an instruction to become self-aware, and we would hope that the earlier excesses might have been worked upon. We see that Taurus's ruler is Venus, and is conjoining Neptune in the fourth house again. There is a lot of importance attached to Charles' home life, and the moon is the natural ruler of the fourth house of the home. Much work is carried out in the privacy of Charles's home life, where we would expect that he has worked upon those excesses throughout his life. Also, the moon is conjunction the north node, and this may help his moon to aspire to what the soul is leading him towards. We note that the esoteric ruler of Taurus is Vulcan, which is a first-rate planet, and it purifies in the fires of the furnace, which Vulcan works in the materialistic way. This works out in the 10th house for the prince, and purification takes place in a very public way, fostering a development of spiritual responsibility, emphasized by Taurus ruler Venus, conjunction the spiritual Neptune, which is, as I said, the sole ruler of Charles's chart. Taurus is a fourth-rate sign, and some of the negative aspects of this ray are self-centeredness, worrying, inaccuracy, lack of moral courage, strong passions, indolence, and extravagance. These vices should be under his control by now and are not obvious from analyzing his public appearances, whereas the positive aspects of ray 4 are strong affections, sympathy, generosity, devotion, quickness of intellect and perception, and are more pronounced in his character. and some other influences, the exoteric keywords of the 10th house ruler Aries is let form again be sought. I believe he's probably overcome with the esoteric keywords, I come forth and from the plane of mind I rule. This is quite a fitting phrase for his position as heir apparent. The keynote points towards Mercury as the ruler of the mind and also esoteric ruler of Aries. He has the mental ability spoken about and will have transcended his moon's prison and have become soul-led. Another important facet of the chart is the Grand Trine, which picks up some important points and another pointer towards regal prominence. The Grand Trine is in fire signs as well. The Midheaven and its ruler Mars are both in a trine relationship with Pluto in the first house, and earlier mentioned that the mutual reception of Pluto and the Sun. Placing the Sun over Pluto points to another regal indicator, and the flowing influence of the Grand Trine could signal his rise to the throne. And the Moon's nodes, these can plot the pathway of the soul during the lifetime. Mercury is the higher or esoteric ruler of Aries on the 10th house cusp and conjuncts the south node in the 4th house in Scorpio. Life for Charles at home may have been sensual with deep feelings. His path leads to the 10th house north node. That's conjunct the Moon, which is the 4th house's natural ruler. Again, a natural link up with opposite signs indicates the merging of soul intention. The prominence of the 4th house and the 10th house illustrates the importance of these two areas of Charles's life, much more than anything else, really. And that's about it, really. I just wanted to pick up one thing that is not quite apparent on the chart, and that is a mystic triangle, a mystic rectangle, which is there in three parts. There's a sextile between Uranus and Gemini in the 11th and the conjunction of the Moon and the North Node in the 10th. Both of those have trines to them. And although it doesn't show a connection between those two trines, those two points, they are in fact sextile down at the bottom between the North Node, Mercury, with Jupiter in Saturn in the fifth. I'm not quite sure the meaning of the mystic triangle. I'm sure I'm sure it has something to do with a mystic or religious or spiritual experience. But I did notice that in the previous chart, and it wasn't alluded to, that there was also a mystic rectangle in that chart. Furthermore, there was another mystic rectangle. An earlier chart, I think that was on Rudolf Steiner. So I was just querying really what Biel and Eva thought about that. But basically that's me finished.
It's good that you pointed that out, but I would also like to mention that this one doesn't come through the point of this. Even though they're technically sextile, this is out of sign, and that's the reason it doesn't show up on here. But you're correct. They are in within orb to be the full mystic rectangle. Actually, the mystic rectangle, it's formed by favorable aspects, the benefits of the trine and the opportunity of the sextiles. And even though it's called a mystic rectangle, it doesn't necessarily have to have mystic abilities to it. But what it does have is it's a creative energy. You know, you've got the opportunity and the benefit and these favorable aspects provide that energy that actually lets you take those things and use them in the manner that the planets are addressing. And yeah, we would have liked to have gotten to that in the previous one and in some of the other ones, but there's just like so much information that we had to condense some of it. But it's nice that you pointed that out here. And look at what we're talking about here, okay? So we're talking the moon and the north node. So it's something from the past, because the moon is the past, yet the north node is that new direction that we're going towards, the destiny, the opportunity. It's in Taurus, so that brings the enlightenment. It brings, we've got Uranus in there. Actually, Uranus is out of sign too. But anyway, it's got Uranus in there, which is the higher consciousness, the intuition. In Gemini, which is also the messenger, Jupiter, the expansion, the ability to expand on it. And both Jupiter and Uranus are in the very last degrees of their sign. Technically, to be, you know, fully on spot, it would be 0 degrees of what Cancer. Comes next? Cancer. 0 degrees of Capricorn. But yeah, and then what's the other point that's involved? Oh, the South Node. So again, you know, the Moon here brings in the past. The South Node brings in the past. Mercury here brings in the messenger. Gemini brings in the messenger. It's more of these little mutual receptions like you were talking about. So, you know, all of that is involved in it. Scorpio digging deep within his roots, the fourth house, and it's playing out in the fifth house of creativity that's going to shine forth in what he does for humanity in the 11th house, and in the 10th house, his career. So I think it's very important that you brought this out for the man who would be king.
So BL, before I say anything, is there more you'd like to add about the chart in general, and then I'll finish it?
I was actually going to talk a little bit about the T-square, but I like the idea of the mystic rectangle, so let's say enough of that. So go ahead, please, Eva.
Okay, and like Vera, I thought that your analysis, your delineation was excellent. You covered a lot of ground here, and I will not go into the areas you have covered. I do want to deal with the sun and the moon, but before I do that, since we've talked a lot about the moon and that the moon is of the past and it's opposite the south node, which is also of the past, they're in opposition, it makes me wonder, well, the north node, which is the future, is also in Taurus and it's right beside the moon. So I'm thinking, what's the deal here for him? What has he got to do if he's brought all this past, which is, as you said, excesses, but that past or that Taurus is trine to other Earth signs, and so that's part of the grand trine, even though Jupiter is out of sign, but it's at 29 degrees. That earthiness is, I see it as working in this garden, working in the horticultural part of his life and the environment. So that is of the past. This, he came into this life knowing how to do that. It's in Taurus. It's working with the earth. He knows how to do all of that. So that cannot be his future. But yet, it's in the 10th house. So it's being seen. It's being seen by the public that he can do this and he can do it well. So what is the destiny here? Why is the destiny conjunct his past? Well, as I think about it, Taurus, besides being, you know, able to work with your hands and being earthy, Taurus is the visionary, the illuminator of the Ajna Center. And I think BL just said the illuminator. So it's the sign of vision, as also is Sagittarius, the sign of vision. So he's got both of those quite strong in his chart. So this vision, he needs to bring the vision somehow as a leader, Leo, as a king, Leo, to humanity. And so that humanity can see whatever that vision, whatever that illumination that he can bring out to humanity. it may or may not have anything to do with his seventh reignus of the environment, of the plant kingdom, the vegetable kingdom, but he has to bring some kind of vision to humanity, or I think, and I think that that's where his destiny lies. I question where his seventh ray is. There's a lot of people in incarnation with a high seventh ray soul, and I think with all his involvement, and aside from all his, there's a dignity to him. It's the way he holds himself and he carries himself. Now, I'm sure the monarchy has taught him all of that. They all do. But I really feel that or pick up that seventh ray from him. And so I wonder if, besides the physical form, if he has it as a soul ray. I'm just putting that out as a possibility. But the two areas I wanted to cover were both the moon and the sun. Because the sun is the ruler on all three levels, exoteric, esoteric, and hierarchical, of his ascendant, we have to look at what they veil, especially if he's a disciple, which I believe he is. What does the sun veil? We can start off with Jupiter, which is the personality planet. Then we move up to Neptune, which is more the soul planet. So I'm asking you, Ron, being in Scorpio for him, which is about the psychology of himself, of the family, because it's in the fourth house, the depth that he's had to go through to for greater understanding because he's got his mind there. What do you think that that sun veils for him? Do you think it veils Jupiter or do you think it veils Neptune?
I think it veils Neptune, to be honest.
I tend to agree with you.
Yeah, because you were talking about, you were alluding to the North Node and his destiny, really, weren't you? His vision.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's really Neptune, isn't it?
It could be, but you know, the ruler of the Ajna really is Venus, and it's conjunct Neptune. But I tend to agree. I do think it is Neptune. So Neptune then has to play a fairly large role here for him that we haven't really given it that much weight. So both Neptune and the fact that it's conjunct Venus is an important thing to look at. Then we also look at the moon. What does the moon veil for him here? Do you think it veils Vulcan or do you think it veils Neptune?
I don't really know. I suppose it could be either.
Well,
it's Neptune again, is it?
I don't know. I mean, these don't know him well enough, but it's something worth thinking about. If I think that his whole approach here has to be to bring some kind of enlightenment, some kind of vision, some kind of illumination that others will see, that humanity will see as being king or the possibility of being king with that Leo rising, because Leo is the king, right? Leo is the king of the jungle, he's the king. And it's very fitting that Leo would be his ascendant. He's got to bring something. So I do think it's Neptune as well, there as well. So again, if we look at Neptune there, Neptune is the ruler of the sun, not the ruler, but the veiling of the sun. So and also the veiling of the rising sign, it plays a big part for him here, doesn't it? Anyway, those are just things to think about. Things to think about.
Eva, I'd like to add, I'm not disagreeing with you because I think it is highly possible that Neptune could be playing that major role in his life. But what we know about Vulcan is it is more than likely in Scorpio for him. It's going to be within 8 degrees 30 minutes of the sun. So it could actually be in the first, in 00 Sagittarius. Mm-hmm. But more than likely it's for him in Scorpio. And so Vulcan conjunct his sun, which it's always going to be, it's never very far from the sun, could be that major push in his fourth house to transform that personality to the soul levels.
Right, it could be that will that he needs, that strong, the will to persevere and make those changes.
Right, but I'm not ruling out Neptune because that is also a very good possibility. I would like to also say that we mentioned something and we had a question on what we meant when we were talking about Jupiter and Uranus being out of sign with the trines and the sextiles. Trines and sextiles usually go by sign, so a Taurus sextile would be in Cancer. What else is involved here? Yeah, a Scorpio trine would be in Cancer. Taurus trine would be in Capricorn. But because
it's elements, it's elements that we're looking at.
It's elements that we're looking at with these favorable aspects that we've got right here. And this is the very beginning degrees of Taurus, and this is the very ending degrees of Gemini or Sagittarius, which means it's still within that 60 degree window, plus or minus a couple of degrees, that make the aspect, but it's not in the sign we expect it to be in. That's why we say it's out of sign. You're still going to have the energy of the aspect, the opportunity of the sextile, the benefit of the trine, but it's going to be a quirky kind of relationship because it's not in the two elements, the two signs that we would expect it to be in. So you have to determine which one is the one that's out of sign. Are these ones at the 29 degrees out of sign, or are these ones at the 0 degrees out of sign? And I normally go towards the future. These ones are almost, although this is retrograde, but these ones are almost to the next sign. Plus, he's got double in these signs here. So that's why I would say that Uranus opposite Jupiter are out of sign in this particular case. So I hope that answers that question. Okay.
Can I add a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah, looking at the moon and the north node and looking at the fourth house in both the 10th and fourth house, he has a number of planets forming number of oppositions. I see that maybe his mission was to look at the historical role of the monarchy itself and to transform that institution from those excesses, moon in Taurus and North Node in Taurus, transform those excesses of wealth, money, and into more appropriate institution. Yeah, Pluto in the first house as well.
Okay.
So that's I see that connection.
Okay, good. The only other thing is with his with Pluto right almost on the ascendant, and being the ruler of his Scorpio and Pluto both are charismatic. There's a magnetism, a charismatic quality to the man, and so is the sign Leo. There's only two signs, Leo and Scorpio, that we would say that about. You know that they got magnetism, they stand out, and so on. And he's got all these things working for him. That's all I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Great presentation. We're learning so much about all these people.
Yeah.
Okay, Eva.
Okay. So Krishnamurti is my chosen person. And let's look at his, I'm going to just talk about his features in a minute, but soul is the second, these are proposed rays. Soul would be the second ray, the personality the fourth ray, the mind the first ray, emotional second ray, and physical body the seventh ray. So if I don't know how many people know the story behind Krishnamurti, but he was born in late 1800s in India to a middle class Brahmin family. His father was also associated with the Theosophical Society, and in the early part of the 20th century, young Krishnamurti came to be promoted by the leadership of the society, the Theosophical Society, as the world teacher. He was meant to be an experiment. He was meant to be the next world teacher, just like the Jesus was, that the Christ would work through. He was going to be the new Messiah. In 1929, he disavowed that role and dissolved this worldwide organization, and it was called the Order of the Star. He was, according to DK, this is a quote, and it's from Dina too, Krishnamurti was an experiment set out by the Christ. It was only partially successful. The power used by the Christ was distorted and misapplied by the devotee type of which the Theosophical Society is largely composed, and the experiment was brought to an end. So he severed his ties with Theosophy and the Theosophical Society and declared independence from all religious, philosophical, and cultural disciplines and practices. He spent the rest of his life presenting a very unique philosophy all around the world, asserting that only unflinching self-inquiry can lead to genuine discovery and to resolution of all personal and social conflict. So he denounced the concept of saviors, of spiritual leaders. He hated these people hanging on to him and making him something that he felt he wasn't. He wasn't able to live up to that role. And he felt that there was no intermediaries, which he would have been, to reality. He posited that such revolution cannot be brought about by any external entity, or by religion, or by politics, or by social life. He urged people to discover for themselves the underlying causes of the problems facing individuals and facing society. He felt that all of that would bring psychological freedom, which is in everyone's reach, according to him. So he set out to work towards his goal of universal psychological freedom until he died in 1986. He traveled the world wide. He was independent as an independent speaker. He spoke to groups and to interested individuals. I have a number of his books, and there's that very blunt, first-ray, shock approach to the way in which he presents truth. So again, he constantly stressed the need for revolution in the psyche for every human being, by positing that this revolution can only be brought about through self-discovery, not by external entity, not by religion, political or social. So I wanted to bring out here the distinction between soul purpose and destiny. I kind of talked a little bit about it before. Soul purpose is brought about via the soul, We see it in the chart. It's the highest point that one can reach, that the soul can reach in a given life, while destiny is worked out upon the physical plane by the personality according to their understanding of purpose or their purpose. So we see that his north node, right opposite his south node, right here, well, is in Pisces. And Pisces is supposed to be the world savior, just like the Christ was. Did he achieve this world saviorship? I don't think so. So he did not, my point is here, he did not fulfill the proposed destiny. Okay? Aquarius is his ascendant, and the rulers of Aquarius are Uranus and Jupiter. So Uranus is up in the 10th house, Jupiter is down in the 5th house. So, in the ninth house. Uranus was in the ninth house. It gives us a deep focus on his metaphysical teachings. Uranus up there, here, it's in Scorpio, so he's going deep into metaphysical. It's in the ninth house of higher learning. Uranus is also exalted in Scorpio. Emotional control through increased mental strength. Uranus allows a mental polarization with this emotionally intense and intuitive sign. There. enabling a really good measure of astral control, because Scorpio is water, right? It's astrality. Uranus is also known as the Hierophant of mysteries, and Scorpio is the sign of mysteries. Why mysteries? Because it's all that which is hidden, hidden deep. So both of these are signs of mystery, or not signs, but planet and sign. The esoteric ruler of his ascendant is Jupiter. Jupiter conveys the second ray. Jupiter is exalted in Cancer, and it's posited that his soul ray is the second ray. So it reflects here also the high quality of his astral body, because Jupiter, the ruler of his ascendant, is in a water sign. Uranus, the ruler of his ascendant, is in a water sign. So we've got to look at the astrality, and yet they are both exalted in the signs that they find themselves in. So again, I would say, and Michael has told us that Uranus, if it's a really placed, a good Uranus for a highly evolved individual, can speak to perhaps the fourth degree, and this is what I propose that he was going for. So we can see the importance of the placement of both these ruling planets. Now, the esoteric ruler, Jupiter, is in conjunction to the ruler of his sun sign. See, the sun sign's ruler is Venus, right there, and the two, it's out of sign, but they are conjunct. There's only 7 degrees apart. So for those of you that are still questioning what is out of sign, you see, this one is in Gemini, and this one is in Cancer, and yet they're still conjunct because they're still within 7 degrees of each other. So although they're out of sign, they are conjunct. So the ruler of his sun sign, Taurus, is Venus, and it is conjunct that Jupiter that placed exalted in Cancer. So it's a good symbiosis between his soul and his personality. Now we can look at the soul as being Venus, and some people still look at the soul as being Jupiter. So, you know, either way, and they're in the fifth house, the house of the soul, you know, the house of the causal body. So the Aquarius ascendant is squared by the sun sign in Taurus. And this brings a major challenge to manifest the qualities of his Aquarius ascendant. So Aquarius rising with Jupiter as ruler, conjunct Mars. Let's go back here, yes, conjunct Mars. So it's square in the middle between Mars and between Venus. Conjunct Mars indicates soul purpose and points the way, Mars points the way to the future, offering opportunity. See, Mars will push him and drive him. Okay. Also, it is known that Krishnamurti had a strong relationship to women. He got along with women far better than with men. As a matter of fact, that society, the star, was composed mostly of women. And you know, and the mothering quality. So we see that with the Cancer here, and we see that with Neptune also in the fourth house, which is the esoteric ruler of Cancer, right? So even Jupiter can attribute to this as well. Jupiter in Cancer, Neptune in the fourth house. So we see that feminine quality here, the mothering, perhaps all of that. Neptune in the fourth house also reflects Krishnamurti's relationship to his spiritual home, the ashram and the masters. The fourth house is known as the house of your ashram. Now, he's got a T-square between Uranus, up at the top of the chart, in the ninth house, Sun in Taurus, now we see 20 degrees versus 17 degrees, and his ascendant, 18 degrees. They speak to great potential for new Aquarian, because it's Aquarian rising, wisdom teachings that could have come through him via the Lord Maitreya or via the Christ. So we see the potential was there for all the teachings to be given to, you know, humanity through worldwide, through the group. Sun and Uranus are opposed, indicating strong etheric forces also. This may have explained some of Krishnamurti's bad health in his younger years. Why do I say etheric here? Because the sun can, remember, the sun represents the ethers as well as the sun rays. And Uranus is the ruler of the seventh plane, and that is the etheric plane as well. So the combination being in opposition means that it's not all the time, but it certainly at some times can create havoc within one's energy system. It could explain the delicate physical condition that he found himself in. So there are two exaltations in this horoscope, Uranus and Jupiter, which are the rulers of his rising sign. This almost guarantees a successful outcome for this incarnation. Now, I love what Alan Oaken says about Mars and Cancer, because I have that too. He says, Mars in Cancer is the devotion to the soul is at its greatest, which is appropriate for the fifth house, the mansion of the soul, the causal body. I hadn't come across that before, and I found that most interesting. Now we're going to look at Vulcan, which is within 8 degrees on either side of his Taurus sun. Why am I looking at Vulcan, everybody? Because it's the esoteric ruler of his Taurus sun. It's conjunct Mercury, you know, more than likely. Could be the other direction, but I'm going to assume that it's somewhere in between here and conjuncting Mercury, making Mercury tremendously powerful. It's the powerful and the willful communication. Third house and Mercury, even though it's in the fourth house, it's their communicator. It's the signature of an incisive mind, which can also be a destructive mind, with Vulcan there giving it that first ray. And boy, did that come through in all his interviews, because most of the books are based on the interviews with him. And boy, incisive, you know, like they cut, they really cut. So it kind of works with the proposed first train mind. I'm just about finished here, guys. We won't go too long. Moon in Sagittarius in the 11th house right here. This is the Aquarian house. It indicates the teacher of wisdom who was available to the world in a most Aquarian way. Why do I say teacher? Because of Sagittarius. Sagittarius is the teacher. And look at that. This is at 25 degrees. And it shows here that it's opposite his Jupiter. Oh, no, sorry, Venus at 28 degrees. So they're in opposition to each other. And remember, Venus, we kind of talked about it as perhaps being that quality of the soul, being in the fifth house, and Venus is many times looked at as the soul, especially next to Jupiter. And it's right opposite his moon. So again, there's energy flowing between him as a teacher, being able to call upon these soul qualities, and in the Aquarian house. Pluto in Gemini, right here. Pluto in Gemini would have given Krishnamurti an enormously penetrating mind, and works again well with the proposed first ray mind. It's in Gemini, guys, you see? So it's penetrating. This, I'm wondering if that would bring in a lot of the Buddhic qualities for him, being related here to the fourth house. I have a little note here about Scorpio. as the MC right here. MC represents a person's dharma. Do we know what dharma means? It means duty. It's greater than responsibility even, but it's duty, it's dharma, of what one must achieve in a life. Krishnamurti said that his real dharma had to do with awakening self-knowledge in the individual. And that's what he professed all along. Mars rules his MC, right? The Scorpio, Mars is down here. It rules his MC. Exoterically and esoterically, and its placement is in Cancer in the fifth house, could very well reflect the statement that he wants to bring about awakening self-knowing in the individual. Why do I say that? Because Cancer is nurturing, the individual could be Mars, and self-knowing in the fifth house. So that's basically my take on Krishnamurti, and I'm open to any questions or comments from you, BL.
I just want to mention, since Ray brought it up, and we have seen it in several other charts, that he also has that mystic rectangle mm-hmm. there. It involves, for him, his Sun-Earth axis, and of course Uranus is conjunct his Earth. And actually, the MC is in there, too, although you use a little tighter orbs for the sextiles. But it's there, the MC, I see. And then that would bring in Mercury down here, too. But anyway, that with the nodes, that forms the other axis. These two axes are sextile each other, and so they form the trines and everything that goes along with that mystic rectangle. And it also ties, you know, you mentioned that fixed cross that he has, or you mentioned the T-square part of it, the Sun-Earth axis with Uranus in there squaring his ascendant, but it's also squaring his descendant, which is over there, you know, and that forms that T-square or that fixed cross. But then the Moon and his Venus are also loosely squared his nodes again. So this mystic rectangle that he has actually ties his squares with his Sun and the squares with his the fixed cross and the mutable cross together. So he had, you know, the fact that you're saying that he had was probably around the fourth initiation. He had the potential in there to use this stuff. Now, whether it was the experiment that went awry, which sounds like it may not have necessarily been due to his fault, but to the other people who put him on that pedestal when they really shouldn't have, or whether he had that inner agenda that he came for when he rejected their plan. He had that sustained capability from the mystic rectangle, the opportunity and the benefits that he'd earned, to use that for the work of the cross, which wasn't going to be easy for him, but he basically had that showing up, the energy showing up in his chart to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. I would also say, if we're talking about an initiate, possibly working on the fourth initiation, that we would be looking at the hierarchical rulers, and so the Sun could have been veiling Uranus for him, right, especially since it's opposite in that cross or T-square with the ascendant.
Right. You know, I didn't go into the hierarchy because we haven't touched on that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We should really have considered a lot of the hierarchical rulers here for his luminaries too.
Right. So there's a lot of potential within the chart, but it's also how that soul, what opportunities they take advantage of, and what their work is, basically.
Right.
So I guess
one of
I'm
the things that I meant to point out with some of the other two charts is when you have planets that are dignified, that means they are in the sign that they normally rule. When you have planets that are
exalted,
thank you. And what's the other one I'm looking for? There's not in detriment. When they're not in detriment, when they don't fall, but they're exalted and they're dignified, which means it's very favorable, you have to look at the person's life. This person was meant to use these favorable energies in a particular way. As the other two that we were looking at, there were so many either dignified, or I made a list of it and I didn't mention it, either dignified or exalted placements for the other two charts as well. But here, look, we've got Venus in Gemini. We have we've mentioned Cancer in Jupiter in Cancer. That was mentioned before as well. I'm just trying to think. Okay, I guess that's about it. Yeah, that's it. Oh, yeah, let's go back to the picture. I did say I would talk about it. One of the things, I can't open it up. One of the things that I learned about morphology is sometimes people with a strong Taurus show it in their eyes. There is, not that they're eyes of the bull, it sounds gross when I say that, but his eyes give away that look. It's a Taurian look in his eyes, whether when he was young and even later on as he started to show age. They're very Taurian. Do we see that? It's kind of bulgy eyes. And if you think of people that you know whose eyes kind of protrude a little bit, you have to ask whether or not Taurus is prominent in their sign. So that's interesting that he has that Taurian quality. And the other thing I thought I would mention is that, is it synchronous or is it serendipity that many often when we have three presenters with three different charts, the signs seem to be so similar? We have found in these charts that we're working on, we have found Taurus in some of the charts. We certainly have found Scorpio very strong in these charts, not Leo for this one, but there's a similarity in energies. At least the first two were very similar luminaries in certain signs that were overlapping. So,
and even Eva, even the Manuel Fah, he died 14th of November, and Prince Charles was born on 14th of November.
Yeah, so it seems to, like, we don't plan this, but it seems to be quite synchronous that it just happens that way, that we work with similar energies. Just thought I'd point that out.
Well,
no
I
question.
Think it's worked, I think the whole thing has worked out that way, from this one to our next presentation, which will be the last three presentations that students give, and then we'll do the final wrap-up.
Which is a teaching.
Yeah. The final wrap-up in June will be a teaching one. There is none in April, and the last three student presentations will be in 16 May. So, yeah, this has been a really great series, and I really appreciate the work that everybody did for this particular webinar and the ones that led up to it. So I don't see any more questions. Do we have any before we say goodbye, or does anybody have anything else to say before we end this particular webinar? Yes. Okay. Go ahead, Yvonne.
Am I presenting sometime? Is that what I'm looking at?
I thought you did it already.
I did too, but it says yes, present.
Oh, I see. That's you know what? This was copied onto a previous one.
I'm sorry. It? Yeah. That's me.
You just made me real nervous there for a minute.
No, you're fine. Okay. You know, when we create these, things, many times use a previous slide, and I guess the names weren't changed.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So you're okay, Yvonne. Okay, so I think if that's it, adios, everybody, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being a part of this, and I thought that you presenters did a super job.
Thank you.
Thank you.